Let me tell you, if we didn't win, the stock market would have crashed. And the market was going up a lot before the election because it was looking like we had a good chance to win. And then went up tremendously from the time we won the election till the time we took office, which was November 8th to January 20th. And that's our credit. That's all our credit. And leading up to that point was our credit because there was hope. And one of the reasons the stock market's gone up so much in the last few days is people think we're doing so well. They liked the State of the Union speech.
President Donald Trump speaking today after the Senate acquitted him in his impeachment trial, a victory lap, if you will. He again took credit for the strong economy, something he talked a lot about during his State of the Union speech.
The unemployment rate for African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans has reached the lowest levels in history.
Well, with election season now fully upon us, Trump is expected to focus a lot on the economy to boost his case for four more years. It is by far his strongest issue, with unemployment at record lows and the stock market at record highs. But for a lot of people, they're just not feeling it for lots of reasons. The high price of health insurance, housing, childcare, and also a spike in homelessness. Here to talk about the disconnect between the economic numbers and the reality many people face is Lynette Lopez. She's a columnist at Business Insider who focuses on U.S. politics and economics. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thanks. And to talk about the California piece of this, we're joined by Chris Thornburg, founding partner at Beacon Economics. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, good to be here, Madeline.
Good to have you. Lynette, let's begin with you. So, bottom line, why does the economy feel so bad to a significant portion of Americans when the numbers are so good?
Well, I think you got to some of it in what you were saying before. Inflation is a huge issue, and the cost of just getting by in America has risen significantly over the last 30 to 40 years, whether it's childcare, the cost of higher education, healthcare, while wages have pretty much been stagnant. You know, one thing that Donald Trump said in his State of the Union speech was that incomes are soaring. That's hardly the case. We haven't really seen great wage inflation since, you know, in maybe 30 years. There was a great little break right before the dot-com crash in 2000. But other than that, wages have been pretty stagnant. And the little wage growth that we have seen is significant only because it's in comparison to the financial crisis when we lost, obviously, a lot of jobs when people weren't getting paid really well. So that is just one thing that that I think really, really is weighing on the minds of many Americans and is a significant part of why, even though the jobs numbers are good, people who do have jobs are still having trouble making ends meet. And so,
yeah, but the consumer confidence numbers are up. And then when Americans are asked what they think is going to happen in the next few months, they're pretty optimistic when it comes to the labor market. And a new survey out from Pew this week says nearly 70% of Americans feel satisfied with this economy.
I mean, sure, it's definitely better than we experienced over the last 10 years. I think, you know, the comparison and getting pulled out of the great financial crisis has a big factor on how we view the economy. And that's something that has carried over from the Obama administration. Donald Trump tries to take a lot of pains to separate his economy from Obama's economy. But in reality, you know, they're really not that different. We had a short term sugar high from his tax cuts, but productivity has been relatively anemic, as it has been throughout this recovery, and it's slowing down. And we're seeing job creation slow down as this recovery gets long in the tooth.
Chris, what do you think? Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes and no. I will start out by taking issue with probably the biggest mistake and what was just said, which is the idea that wages aren't going up. The wage numbers that are being cited here are broken numbers. They come out of the current population survey. They don't give an accurate reading. They're not real numbers. And unfortunately, that's also true for some of the data that comes out of the census. There's problems with these data sets, and if you look at them wrong, you don't understand what they're saying. And of course, that doesn't even capture anything, because those wage numbers don't tell you about quality of life. You know, we live in a time of unprecedented medical technology. We have ways of dealing with things that make our lives incalculably better. we all have a smartphone in our pocket, which gives us unlimited access to entertainment, information, and communication with anybody anywhere in the world instantaneously. And these things aren't even counted in the data. So the idea that Americans don't have the best standard of living ever is absolutely preposterous. We absolutely do. And we should start appreciating it as we look to solve the very real problems around us, as opposed to inventing a problem that doesn't exist.
Okay, so there's a lot there. And I guess what I'm hearing you say is it depends on how you look at your life, in a way. Then it's all full of these intangibles. Like, do you like the fact that you have a smartphone in your pocket? A lot of people don't. They feel chained to it. You know, and those are kind of intangibles that don't, I guess, get reflected.
Yeah, but you have a choice to get rid of that phone if you don't
true.
Want it there.
That's
so true. The idea that you're complaining about it seems a little bit of a false narrative to me.
Okay, well, and some of us have to use them for our work. But anyway, let's set that aside. But just the overall feeling, it's very difficult to measure, right? I mean, you do have these consumer confidence numbers. You do have these Pew surveys, as I mentioned, but there is a kind of an inchoate, intangible feeling. And when you look at other markers, Lynette, such as a lot of, I don't know, drug addiction, a lot of the negative savings rate, the fact that college students are facing a lot of debt, and people who graduated from college a long time ago are still paying off that debt. That all figures into all of this stuff, right?
Our politics scream uncertainty. I mean, there's no question that that people are not feeling as confident just because they have an iPhone in their pocket, or just because we have amazing medical advancements. It doesn't matter if we have amazing medical advancements if people don't have access to them. So while I understand what you're saying, it sounds very much like somebody who has profited from the system as it has been over the last 30 years. But I think that young people often feel like access to the benefits of American society are being shut to them. And there is a pessimism among millennial and Gen Z that maybe older people don't feel. But I do agree that Donald Trump mostly inherited the Obama recovery. That's certainly true. And he has certainly done as much as possible to blow it up. And I think that another question we have to ask ourselves is, if the economy is doing so well, why are companies so over-levered, as if they need to take on leverage to deal with, you know, a struggling economy, when supposedly they're doing really, really well and consumers are confident in buying things? Why are they taking all this debt, and why is that debt deteriorating in quality? We need to ask ourselves these questions, because at the end of the day, you can blame the Federal Reserve for keeping interest rates low, but no one is making corporations borrow so much money. No one's forcing their hand. So why do they feel the need to do something like that? And why is it that as they're doing it, productivity, again, in this country remains anemic? Why are they not investing the cash that they have, the money that they're borrowing, in making this economy more productive and in raising wages, even though the labor market is tight? Wages are not going up as much as many people would expect for them to go up in a labor market this tight. So why is that? Why are companies using their money the way they are? Why are they allocating capital as if there is stress in the system when everyone is saying everything is fine, or at least by the metrics the president is using, it is fine?
Yeah, that seems like a big question. Chris, do you have a theory as to why the Trump tax credits were supposed to be used
to
help businesses?
You know, can I start out with the first question? Because
yeah.
Your question you just asked was, why do people not feel confident? And I'll tell you why they don't feel confident. We have this weird necessity to somehow or other run around and present the data in incorrect ways that presents a picture of an economy that really is not true. There's plenty of issues out there, whether you want to talk about wealth inequality, the desperate need for pension reform. But if we sit around and tell stories about the current economy claiming it's bad when it's not, that wages aren't rising when they are, that quality of life isn't improving when it is, well, then we kind of have to blame ourselves for why we feel so insecure. And that's
the
biggest shame of all.
So
we should appreciate what we have.
Do you both agree that we, in general, Americans don't feel confident, despite the consumer confidence numbers, that we're feeling an unease, that we don't feel as great as perhaps we should? Do you both agree on at least that?
I think that those statements you just made are so hard to pin your finger on. You just, how can you say we're not confident when you said this consumer confidence is high?
I know. Well, because you just said that.
I don't
that
understand,
we feel,
even understand the question.
Well, you just said we feel an unease and anxiety.
Well, we feel the need to run around and tell everybody how bad things are when they're not. And that's, like I said, that's the biggest shame of all.
But is it that what Lynette said, that perhaps we're looking at different demographics, that maybe people who are a little more established in their careers and their lives and maybe have a house feel better than people who don't?
Let me put it slightly differently, okay? So we know that if you look across different demographic groups in the United States, we know that single moms have the highest rate of poverty. And that's not a surprise. Being a single mom has got to be just a brutally difficult thing. And as a society, we owe these people as much support as we can give them as they work through to raise those kids on their own, right? However, I can also say in the same breath that being a single mom today is better than ever having been a single mom before was. Because, you know, 15 years ago, if you're a single mom and you needed to get supplies, you were probably putting your kids on a bus to get to the local store. Now you got your smartphone, because 90% of Americans have a smartphone, and Amazon is dropping off that food and diapers at your doorstep the next day at a very reasonable price. So we can say in the same breath that there are people around us that need help, and we as a society have a due to help those folks and get them ahead in life. However, we can say at the same time that they have it much better off than they did 10 or 15 years ago. Why are those two statements incompatible?
Lynette?
What does that matter when they're struggling right now? I mean, you're telling people to be like, oh, well, 15 years ago, I would have been XYZ. That doesn't matter when people are trying to pay their bills. I don't understand this logic.
Chris?
But you're saying it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. If people are struggling right now, they're not saying to themselves, well, you know, actually, let me just calm down on my needs and wants for this moment, because 15 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, I would have been in a much worse situation. So I should just thank my lucky stars. That's not how life works.
Yeah. So I guess, it's really instructive to see just how subjective the view on the economy can be, depending on where you are in it. And what I find a little perplexing is when you look at the numbers, we are all supposed to believe that the economy is doing great for all of us. And if we don't feel that way, we feel perhaps that there's something wrong with us and our decisions. Is that an accurate way of putting it?
Well, I would argue that I didn't say what was just suggested. I would tell you that as a society, we have to help these people, but we can also acknowledge that we're getting ahead in life. Because people are getting ahead in life doesn't mean we shouldn't also be continuing to help these segments of society and in trying to improve things. But saying that things are improving, acknowledging that they are improving in no way, shape, or form diminishes the need to continue to help. But my point is if we sit around and are constantly telling stories about decline that don't exist, then I think what we do is we lose focus on what we really need to be focusing on. And we get pulled off on these incredible tangents. We end up spending our energy pursuing social goals that are impossible and in many ways potentially dangerous. Indeed, I would argue in many ways it was the Make America Great Again theme that brought Trump to power.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, this idea that we can't acknowledge how good things have become because of changes in technology and efficiencies in our economy, that led to Trump.
You can say that these technological advancements and changes in our economy have created social dislocations as well. I mean, this is what we're seeing with, you know, companies moving out of the United States of America and the economy changing. There are winners and losers of economic change. And just because we're celebrating ourselves and patting ourselves on the back for being winners doesn't mean that we cannot discuss and try to understand, one, where the economy is going and how we can mitigate those changes in the future, which is the point of understanding corporate leverage and everything, all of those things that are happening in the economy at the moment and not comparing. Anyway, one point is mitigating the dangers going forward. And the other is looking back and trying to establish what happened when people were left behind and what kind of economy they're pushing for, because obviously it is impacting our politics. And as not a fan of Donald Trump, I will say to our detriment. So these are not delusions that people have. They are transforming themselves into political realities. And by dismissing them, you are like missing part of the story here, which is that this is real because we think it's real.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you both for a very lively and informative discussion. Lynette Lopez, columnist at Business Insider, Chris Thornburg, founding partner at Beacon Economics. Thank you both. Coming up, dramatic testimony in the Harvey Weinstein trial. The prosecution rests. We'll tell you what happened next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. New York prosecutors rested their case today in Harvey Weinstein's sex crimes trial. Six of Weinstein's accusers testified over 2 weeks and described in graphic detail what the former movie producer allegedly did to them. Just two of them are tied to the charges filed against Weinstein. We're going to talk about what happened in the trial so far with Jan Ransom. She's been covering it for the New York Times. And just a warning to listeners, some of the details we'll be discussing are pretty graphic. Hi, Jan.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. All right. So it's been quite a ride these last 2 weeks, right? A lot of emotional testimony. The trial had to be stopped at one point because one of the witnesses had a panic attack. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's correct. So one of the key witnesses, Jessica Mann, broke down under cross-examination this week. She is the witness, if you recall, who accused Mr. Weinstein of raping her at the DoubleTree Hotel in March 2013. She's also the witness who acknowledged having maintained a relationship with Mr. Weinstein, she said, in order to save her career.
Hmm. So she admits that after this alleged rape, they had a relationship. What kind of relationship?
She said that she had this relationship that was, you know, mostly sexual. She described trying to have a quote unquote normal relationship with him, but she explained being a bit worried about his power and how he could use his power to hurt any chances of her becoming an actress. She had auditioned for Vampire Academy and had hoped to, you know, build a career through her connection with Weinstein, but it doesn't seem like that happened.
Mm. And she was on the stand for about 3 days, right, which is much longer than the other witnesses?
Yes, she was. The defense, it seemed, believed she may have been the weakest of the witnesses, mostly because of the relationship that she kept with Weinstein long after the alleged assault. And they thought that they could, you know, use her testimony to possibly discredit the other witnesses as well.
Hmm. And so under cross-examination, what did Harvey Weinstein's lawyer say?
So they focused on Jessica Mann's own words. She exchanged dozens of emails with the producer over about 4 or 5 years. In those emails, she's saying loving things. In one instance, she's saying that, you know, she would like for the producer to meet her mother, explaining that, you know, he could see where her genes came from, and, you know, also, you know, cheering him on and saying that she could not wait to see him again. You know, this kind of goes on and on and on countless times.
Wow. What was the story with the photos of Harvey Weinstein being shown to the jury? Naked photos.
Sure. Yeah. So Jessica Mann and another witness, Lauren Young, who was on the stand yesterday and a bit of today, they both described Mr. Weinstein's genitals as being deformed, and I'm not sure how much I can get into as far as a description during this interview, but, you know, they described in very graphic detail what they look like, with Lauren Young calling it his, you know, genitals disgusting. And so the pictures, it seems, were meant to sort of back up what these women were saying, to show that they're not making this up. And the jurors were the only ones allowed to see it. The public, the viewers in court were not allowed to see these photos.
So it was just basically to prove that they're not making this up, that they actually saw him naked. But was it also to, I don't know, to elicit some kind of response from the jury along the lines of disgust?
I mean, I guess, you know, the assumption could be made there. There was very obvious sort of facial responses from the jury. You could see, like, one male juror kind of raise his brows, another woman kind of, you know, turn her head sharply. So it certainly had that effect.
And what was Harvey Weinstein's response to all of this?
Oh, yeah. So the moment Jessica Mann got into describing what he looked like naked, including mentioning that he had, like, his back was covered in blackheads and the description of his genitals, he kind of threw his arms up in frustration at the remark.
Sort of like, I can't believe this. This is ridiculous.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Like, he didn't see it coming.
Didn't he fall asleep during parts of her testimony?
He has nodded off here and there, not only during parts of her testimony, but throughout the trial.
And so we just talked a lot about Jessica Mann. She's one of the key witnesses for the prosecution, one of the two who are form the basis for the allegations. What about the other woman, Mimi Halle? What about her testimony, and how did that go over?
Yeah, so Mimi was on the stand for a much shorter time. She has accused Mr. Weinstein of forcibly performing oral sex on her at his apartment in Tribeca in 2006. Her testimony, the defense lawyers also tried to pounce on because she, too, sort of maintained a relationship with him, you know, exchanging emails for a number of years, turning to him for help with work. There was an instance where, you know, she wrote an email to him, "I need to feed my cat," and asking him to assist her. And so to counter that, you know, prosecutors have said that, you know, Mimi and Jessica, you know, were in different positions than Harvey Weinstein. They needed help. They wanted to break into the business. And Mr. Weinstein essentially took advantage of that, is what they're suggesting.
So now the defense gets to present their case. Do you expect more of the same from his defense attorneys, basically saying these women were in it for their own professional gain? They actually had a relationship with Harvey Weinstein. They weren't sexually assaulted. Is that going to be the line of defense?
Absolutely. I mean, the defense is presenting their case starting today, so we don't know yet who is testifying or who to expect. They will be calling an expert witness to talk about memory and how it is not as reliable as time goes on. But yeah, we're expecting, you know, more of the same. They're going to try to support their claim that these women were in consensual sexual relationships with Mr. Weinstein, and this was all to advance their own career or for some other benefit.
All right. Jan, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Jan Ransom. She covers criminal courts for The New York Times. Coming up, it is the 100th anniversary this year of Prohibition.
An absolutist solution of prohibiting beer, wine, and distilled liquors in one fell swoop created far more problems than it could possibly have solved.
Even though it was repealed 13 years later, its effects are being felt today. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 100 years ago, Prohibition officially went into effect. The 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prohibited the manufacture, the sale, the transportation of intoxicating liquors across the United States. Sure, there is some romantic nostalgia about Prohibition, speakeasies, jazz music, flappers, The Great Gatsby, the movie Some Like It Hot.
What'll it be, sir?
Booze.
Sorry, sir, we only serve coffee.
Coffee?
Scotch coffee, Canadian coffee, sour mash coffee.
Scotch, negative Demitasse, soda on the side.
Well, entertainment aside, there were some wide-ranging consequences that still resonate a century later, such as how this amendment changed our criminal justice system, how it changed the makeup of the Democratic Party, how it gave the Ku Klux Klan power. Plenty of lessons from the 1920s we can apply to the 2020s, especially when it comes to illegal drugs. Well, to talk about all of that, we are joined by Lisa McGurr. She's a history professor at Harvard University and author of the book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So it took a while to get this amendment on the books, right? Like about 100 years. Who was pushing for it?
For most of the 19th century, it was largely religious crusaders, evangelical Protestant men and women who saw the prohibition issue and saw alcohol really as a sin, the devil's drink. By the early 20th century, you had the rise of the progressive movement, and you also had tremendous anxieties over mass immigration. So the movement moved from just a set of religious crusaders to a whole host of reforming, spirited men and women who saw banning alcohol from shore to shore as a way of bettering the nation and of reining in the cultural change that all these massive numbers of immigrants were bringing to the nation's big metropolitan centers.
Well, when you say it's progressives, what exactly were they agitating for? Because when you nowadays, when you think about progressives, you don't associate them with also being anti-immigrant.
That is correct. So the progressive era and what progressivism meant was somewhat different in the early 20th century than it would be thought about in the 21st century. So it was led by largely Protestant men and women, sort of those who had been in the country for many years, who were deeply concerned about the changes that all the wave of European immigrants were bringing to the nation. So they did want to use the federal government and state power to bring about sets of economic reform. So in that way, one can think about it similar to what a progressivism might be today.
And so it's interesting that you hear this echoes now with drugs and immigrants coming from the southern border. There's a rhetoric around that these immigrants are bringing in illegal drugs. Was it the same kind of rhetoric that the European immigrants, the Italians, I guess, they were talking about, or the Jews or whoever else,
right,
were coming
and
bringing alcohol?
Those who were in the early 20th century, the concern over mass immigration was about European immigrants and largely, as you mentioned, Italians, those from Southern Europe who were new immigrants, those from Eastern Europe, many of whom were Catholic. So it's also an issue that's linked to religiosity and the shifting parameters of religiosity in the early 20th century. But there is very much that sort of targeting of this group that are thought of in kind of social discourse as kind of dangerous, kind of criminal others that you see both in the what I call the war on alcohol and the later war on drugs. These campaigns were used in a way as forms of social control, using kind of anxieties, sort of kind of moral panics around certain kinds of social change to target particular groups.
Well, of course, now we see prohibition as a big failure, and it was deemed that way officially because it was repealed. But how did it succeed in perhaps mobilizing groups that had not been really within the political powers? How did it succeed in mobilizing these groups that perhaps were targeted to have more political power?
Because we think of it as a failure, we fail to look at the real long-term impacts that it did have. And one was, as you mentioned, mobilizing men and women who previously had been either outside of the national political process or when they were brought into the political process at all, that is ethnic immigrant working class men and women in urban industrial cities, it was done so at the local level through their local ward boss. So by 1928, Al Smith comes out forcefully. He's himself an immigrant, a Catholic, and he runs for president on the Democratic Party ticket. He mobilizes in droves these immigrant, ethnic, working class men and women into the Democratic Party. And those working class, ethnic men and women stay within the Democratic Party for most of the 20th century. So that's a major shift that happens and in no small part comes about originally out of Prohibition opposition.
And that, of course, coincides with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. How did Prohibition and this amendment, the 18th Amendment, how did that give rise or give more power to the Ku Klux Klan?
Right. So the Klan, of course, this what's called the Second Ku Klux Klan, was established in 1915 in Stone Mountain, Georgia. But what's fascinating about it is it really takes off only around and after 1920. And the Ku Klux Klan is very smart and strategic, and they basically utilize this new law as a way to recruit at the local level. They recruit mostly in white Protestant evangelical communities. Those were precisely the men and women that were the most significant backers of the Prohibition Crusade. And they do so by arguing if your federal government and your state and local police are not able or are not willing to shore up the law, then we will do so. And they essentially became a kind of citizen enforcement force. And they brought in droves of men and women Ku Klux Klan brought in the women, about 5 million members by 1925. And they recruited, around many issues. They were, of course, a white supremacist organization. They were anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic. But one of the primary issues at the local level that they recruited around was this concern over bootlegging. And they would actually forge, in some cases, liquor raids and go out and, as they would put it, clean up the community, but essentially terrorize many of these immigrant Catholic communities, utilizing and instrumentalizing the law to do so.
That's really interesting because I think most of us associate the KKK with terrorizing African Americans, not other white people.
And that's right. And in places like Alabama and places like in the South, the Klan was active and, of course, was very much also, crusading and utilizing the drink issue and other issues to attack African Americans. But you have to remember that in the 1920s, the Klan is growing largely not only in the South, but in the Midwest and the West. And in those places, the issue is really about these immigrant, who are being targeted, immigrant and Catholics.
And so while Prohibition was in effect, were there tons of raids and arrests and people clogging up the court system, being accused of drinking or bootlegging or all that sort of stuff?
First of all, there was tremendous effort at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level to enforce the law. I mean, this was now in the Constitution. Once it was law of the land, folks wanted to give it a chance. So there was a ratcheting up at the federal level, which basically built an entirely new role for the federal government in policing and in surveillance. It was enforced against particular groups of men and women, largely poor, marginal violators. So in other words, it's not wrong to say you could get a drink almost anywhere, and many men and women did drink. But those who were most protected from the long arm of the law were elite men and women, were middle class, those who could drink in protected speakeasies and spaces that were, sort of protected by organized criminal rings.
Well, that sounds familiar when we apply the parallel to the war on drugs.
It does sound familiar. And to be honest with you, when I wrote this book, it was the linkage. I would have never called it the war on alcohol if I had not myself seen the incredible, not only parallels, but the way in which these campaigns were symbiotic. But it was more than just the parallels. I saw that the campaigns were actually symbiotic, which is that once you outlawed alcohol, of course, it was quite logical to then outlaw other substances which were deemed addictive substances that were deemed even more dangerous and that were even more associated with other marginal groups. So you got, during the 1920s, not only enforcement against alcohol, but increasingly a criminal and punitive approach toward recreational drugs. And this is really the moment at the federal level where you see men and women, addicts and traffickers, being put behind federal bars for drug violations. And that's something which begins in the 1920s and, of course, continues well after the rescission of alcohol prohibition. So while there's an end to that one campaign, the other campaign launches forward in new directions and in some ways, of course, has never ended.
Well, of course, it was repealed in 1933 with the 21st Amendment. And widely viewed as a mistake, a big, big mistake. But you've studied a lot of this history, obviously. Where do you think it was successful? Where do you think it was actually a good thing?
Well, I think that successful might be different than how I would term good. Successful was certainly in terms of providing a role for the federal government in terms of policing and expanding the power of the federal government in a way that has not left since. Basically, that new role enabled those men and women in some ways to call for new kind of social provisioning and the New Deal. So I think you can see that in that visibility of a new possibility, possible role for the federal government, there's something positive coming out of it. I also think that there's a way in which prohibition's end to the saloon, which was a singularly male public drinking space where women essentially, if they entered those spaces, could be targeted as prostitutes or at least smeared as such. Once the saloon was shut down, which prohibition actually did successfully, it opened up the door to new forms of heterosocial leisure. And those underground drink spaces forged a kind of mediated a way for women to partake in these public forms of leisure that had not been possible before. And of course, they've remained there ever since.
I don't know if a lot of people would agree that was that's necessarily a benefit or a good thing. I don't know. More women hanging out in bars.
As a woman who doesn't mind going out to a bar and having a drink, I don't think that, the idea of a kind of more acceptable and respectable place for drinking in sort of regulated spaces is something that I see as not a negative outcome. When there are so many plentiful other extremely negative consequences of the law and counterproductive consequences. This was counterproductive in terms of the way those men and women who had fought for the law, what they hoped to achieve out of it.
So it didn't stop drinking, didn't stop public drinking, I guess. It just or just put it in a different place, public place. It didn't really do anything that the temperance movement wanted.
Actually, if you look, it's very hard, right, because the statistics are once drink goes underground, it's hard to chart. The reality is that prohibition basically took something which was intended, had a good intention, which was to deal with the consequences and the ravages of addiction and to try to rein them in. But an absolutist solution of prohibiting beer, wine, and distilled liquors in one fell swoop created far more problems than it could possibly have solved. So I think, if there had been more partial prohibitionary measures, which was something other parts of the world actually experimented with, if the temperance movement had proceeded in the direction of simply working with educational measures and seeing addiction as a kind of public health problem, we would not have that same kind of a criminal approach, which I think in both the war on alcohol and the war on drugs has been extremely counterproductive.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
That's Lisa McGirt. She's a history professor at Harvard and author of the book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition and the Rise of the American State. Coming up, the White House is mulling a directive that would force new federal buildings to look a certain way. Should there be a design standard? And if so, what should it be? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've heard Make America Great Again. Well, get ready for Making Federal Buildings Beautiful Again. It's the title of a draft executive order the White House is mulling. It would discourage modern design by making classical architecture the default style for new federal buildings or renovations of existing buildings. I think Roman and Greek design. Just like the White House. Joining us to talk about this is Robin Pogrebin. She's culture reporter for The New York Times. She wrote about this in the paper. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. And KCRW's very own Frances Anderton, host of DNA, is here to talk about it too. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
All right, Robin, let's begin with you. What exactly does this draft order say?
So basically, this is the draft of an executive order. It is called Making Federal Buildings Beautiful Again, and it was spearheaded by the National Civic Arts Society, which is a nonprofit group that believes contemporary architecture has, quote, in their own words, created a built environment that is degraded and dehumanizing. So this would rewrite the current rules that govern the design of office buildings and headquarters and courthouses in a federal building that costs over $50 million. And
what do the current rules say?
I mean, the current rules make it possible to have a variety of styles. And it was these were established by, in part, Daniel Moynihan in 1962. And the idea was that it was important, in his words, not to dictate exactly. He said there should be a policy should be that the development of an official style must be avoided and design must flow from the architectural profession to the government and not vice versa. So this runs exactly counter to that. And it basically talks in a sort of exasperated tone that that buildings have been kind of the styles have run amok to some extent.
Run amok.
That Americans should feel proud. Well, those are my words describing it, but that Americans should feel proud of their public buildings and respect the architectural heritage of a region. And that instead there have been too many styles that inspire bewilderment or repugnance, that is in the words of the draft, instead of respect.
Okay.
So that is their mandate. Whether or not the president goes for it remains to be seen, but apparently it's coming his way.
Okay. Well, Frances, one person's repugnance is another person's vision of beauty.
Absolutely. And Robin referred to that period after 1962 when the doors opened onto really bringing in new styles. And Kennedy was actually a great supporter of modernism. Modern architecture and art were actually used in the Cold War to actually to send a message abroad of America's kind of openness. It's fascinating how architecture becomes used as a signifier of a state's ideals. I mean, in fact, poor old neoclassicism winds up falling on both sides. You know, the White House and the other neoclassical buildings that these people absolutely love as a representation of the American spirit, you know, those were originally chosen by the founding fathers because the style did symbolize the new nation's self-governing ideals modeled on ancient Greece,
right,
and
democracy,
Republican Rome, yes.
And these great ideals.
But then the very same style was appropriated by Albert Speer for Hitler to design Germania. So the style also is associated with fascism. Mm. So you know, the signifiers are different depending on who utilizes the style. And certainly the modernism or buildings following modernism have used architecture to express ideals. For example, the idea of transparency, that a democratic state might actually want to use a lot of glass, might actually
which is not what you would see in a neoclassical piece of architecture.
Correct. Neoclassical architecture is known for being made of masonry. Mm-hmm. It is about balance. It's about proportion. It features domes, colonnades, columns. But the point is sort of symmetry, poise, balance. And the kinds of buildings that are being objected to sometimes don't necessarily put those qualities front and center. They have other qualities.
Robin, are there particular buildings that were built recently that perhaps spurred this?
Yes. I mean, one of them that they do call out, actually, is the San Francisco Federal Building that was designed by Tom Main. He is a Pritzker Prize winner, which is kind of the Nobel Prize of architecture. And it's been controversial from the start because it doesn't necessarily fit with a lot of other federal buildings in San Francisco or elsewhere. On the other hand, it, you know, won some architectural prizes. So there are those kind of within the architectural establishment who admire it a great deal. But I think there is, you know, there are two schools of thought here. There is kind of the intelligentsia as far as architectural profession is concerned and what they value. And then there's just the general public and whether or not they think a building is ugly or not. And in this case, there were plenty of people who felt like it didn't belong. It was jarring, and it also did have this kind of public plaza that was supposed to encourage people to hang out and gather. And instead, after 5 p.m., after closing time, turned out to be a magnet for the homeless. So that building remains incredibly polarizing. And it is one of those that this report calls out. That said, Tom Main is quoted in our piece. We actually gave him the final word, in which he says that we're a society that's linked to openness of thought. Mm-hmm. And that is always in the process of becoming. And architecture's obligation is to maintain this forward-thinking stance. So I think there is a lot of concern that if you actually start to mandate a design sensibility, that's a dangerous road to go down.
Right. So talk about that a little bit, because Tom Francis,
yes.
You probably know that building pretty well. And he's got several buildings here in Los Angeles.
Yes. And in fact, you could say that a close cousin of the Federal Building in San Francisco is his Caltrans building in downtown L.A. And absolutely, the jury's out on Tom's buildings. There is no question Tom's buildings are provocations. They absolutely are. And they have none of the qualities that I just described that classical architecture does. They don't go for poise and balance. They go for dynamism. They go for a certain, one might call it aggressiveness, but you could call it, there's a certain artistry with the way he uses concrete and steel. There's a Death Star quality to some of his buildings, but they're incredibly dramatic. There's a tendency to use slightly off-kilter forms at times. You won't find the sort of centralized, axial sort of design in classicism. So no question they're polarizing. But I do want to say that right near Caltrans is another federal building, the new Los Angeles Federal Courthouse. That's on First Street. That's that rather elegant glass cube that sits atop concrete at the bottom. It's got a Catherine Opie artwork inside. That, in a way, is kind of that's by the architects SOM, very important in the history of American architecture, modernists. Anyway, that building really does have poise. It's also completely modern. And those kind of buildings, are we really going to say, no, you can't do buildings like that? No, we've got to get out the marble or the faux marble, which you often find these days, and slather our facades with columns.
Well, so Robin, where are we with this? Is this going to happen? And how many buildings would this affect?
I think it would depend. It would affect projects over $50 million. But what's interesting, and we don't know, to what extent the president is aware of the draft as it exists and if he's leaning towards it, although one would think that to some extent this is reflecting his own values. And certainly, he is a builder. And so this does resonate with his own kind of wheelhouse. But I think that what we see is that this is one of those debates that is kind of a perennial. I remember, a modernist building in Goshen, New York, that was designed by Paul Rudolph. That is brutalist, and there's a lot of debate around brutalist buildings, for example. And the then dean of Columbia's Graduate School of Architecture talked about how preservation is not just about saving the most beautiful things; it's about saving objects that are part of our history. And so I think that there is the feeling that this is a healthy debate to have, and that once you start to create a template for how buildings need to look, you lose that sense of kind of individuality and artistic expression that really reflects a generation and an era. And so I think that there will be a lot of outcry if this goes through. We'll certainly be covering it if it does, because it will kind of create this much more uniform aesthetic that I think plenty of people will push back against.
Well, it certainly is a comment on our times. Robin Pogrebin is culture reporter for The New York Times. Francis Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA Design and Architecture, which you can hear on Tuesdays right here on KCRW at 1:30. Thank you both.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, joining us for last thoughts, last words, Michelle Aloy with some listener feedback.
Final thought. Hi.
Hi.
So we asked listeners how they're feeling about the economy after our lively discussion at the top of the show. Brad says he's not feeling great. Brad in LA. He says prices keep going up and I didn't get a refund check for the first time in my 30 years of working because Trump gave people with money all the tax breaks. So he's not feeling so great. Also, not a lot of love for our guest, Chris Thornburg, on Twitter. Our listeners certainly took some issue with some of his thoughts. Rick Izquierda says, so this guy says we're currently in a great economy and we shouldn't go around saying the economy is bad when it's good. That's pretty much the hashtag MAGA mission. We'll leave it there. Chris could maybe come and respond to some of our listeners'
comments. Yeah, and Chris is certainly not a fan of Donald Trump in its entirety.
Okay. But it was a lively debate.
It was a lively debate. Yes. I urge you to go back and listen to it if you missed it. Thank you very much, Michelle Aloy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.